Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 8 of the True Crime All the Time Unsolved podcast. I'm Mike Ferguson, and with me, as always, is my partner in true crime, Mike Gibson. Gibby, how are you tonight?
Man, I'm doing great.
That's good, man. Good to hear. We got some new Patreon supporters that we got to give shout-outs to. Matt, Rebecca, Jordan, Julie, big shout-outs. Thank you for the support. Got to give a special gold star shout-out to Stacy. She's supporting us at our highest level, which is unbelievable. But big thanks to everyone who chooses to support us. Not only the new supporters, but those of you that have been with us for a while and have supported the show for the last few months. It really means a lot. Can't thank you enough. Don't forget to check out our website, truecrimeallthetime.com. Get all of our contact information. We love when you reach out to us. Check out the merchandise page. We got some new merchandise. And also, if you want to support us on Patreon, all you got to do is go to www.patreon.com/truecrimeallthetime. All right, Gibbs, are you ready to tackle another grisly unsolved case?
Yeah, I think I am.
All right, we're starting off with the clip today.
They're the faces of victims, 8 in all, women who once lived and worked among the vacant buildings and sealed storefronts on Frankfort Avenue. One by one, they died at the hands of the serial killer known as the Frankfort Slasher. From 1985 through 1990, night brought terror to the streets of Frankfort.
All right, so that takes the mystery out of what we're talking about tonight.
Now we know.
The Frankfort Slasher.
Frankfort Slasher.
So, possible serial killer operated in and around Frankfort. That's a neighborhood.
Yeah, it's like the lower northeast section of Philadelphia.
Yeah. 85 to 90. There was pretty standard MO, I think. You know, all the victims were sexually assaulted and stabbed to death.
Yeah.
So there wasn't a lot of variation here, I don't believe. And what we're going to see as we talk, as we get into talking about the victims, is that a lot of them were seen with a man that matched the same description. So I think Gibbs and all, there was 8, possibly 9 women that are attached to the Frankfort Slasher, all brutally slain. And the reason why we would say 8 or 9 is because there's one that is questionable in its connection.
Yeah.
But obviously
we'll tackle that when we get there.
Right. We'll detail that out. But, you know, there's something about this Frankfort Slasher that jumped out at me right away. And I think it's that there is a ton of conflicting information on this case. And we'll try to point some of that out as we go along. And I don't know if you've seen it, but I think this is something that I see more with the unsolved cases than I do with the solved that we do on True Crime All the Time. Obviously, the information there is a little more concrete on those because it's a little more known.
Absolutely, it is.
Whereas on the unsolved, like we talk about, a lot of rabbit holes, a lot of conflicting information.
A lot of assumptions going on.
Yep, a lot of assumptions. Now, we said the victims were all female. The other thing about them is they were all, I guess what you'd call, frequent bar patrons.
Yeah, Goldie's.
Yeah, a couple bars. Goldie's was one of the big ones. Another one I saw was a bar called the Happy Tap, which is... Goldie's is on Pratt Street, and the Happy Tap is, I think, on Margaret Street. But Goldie's is the one everything centers around.
Yeah, a lot of connections there. A
lot of connections to this bar called Goldie's. All right, so let's get right into it. You know, the first victim, we got to go back to August 19th of 1985. The first woman found murdered was Helen Patton. She was 52 years old. So they find Helen's body around 8:30 in the morning. And I think this is the first instance of where the information was all over the place, because I found books and websites that put the date of her body being found as the 26th and the 28th. It was kind of,
yeah, I had the same thing.
There was some differing,
right?
And we're not talking about people. I mean, we're talking about newspaper articles and books, right? This isn't just somebody posting something on the internet that we're looking at. So there's definitely some confusion as to when her body was found for some reason. But the one thing I think we can say for sure, it was late August of 1985.
Yeah, we can say that.
The exact date probably doesn't matter quite as much. Now, what does matter is how Helen was found. And she was found nude from the waist down. And she had been posed in a very sexually provocative position. I mean, she had her legs open. Her blouse was pulled up.
Yeah, exposing her breasts.
Her breasts were exposed. So that was done for a reason, right? She didn't fall that way, or she didn't, you know, she was posed. Now, what the reason for that was, we don't know.
No. I mean, we do know she was raped.
Yes.
Right. Sexually assaulted, raped.
She'd been stabbed many times.
And there's, you know, some variations in that, right? From anywhere from what, 19?
To 47.
Well, I mean, clearly 19, 40 or 47 doesn't matter at that point. She's dead. But it's still, I mean, just the.
But they did an autopsy.
Yeah, that's the weird part, is that they come up with this number. Right, this conflicting number.
Yeah. I found that very odd, and I researched it quite a bit.
I think the one interesting part, in addition to what we already said, is that she did have this vicious, deep slash across her abdomen, where they said that you could actually see inside and see her internal organs.
Yeah, I think it exposed internal organs, so you know that was a...
That was brutal.
Brutal slashing.
Yes.
So Gibby Patton lived in Parkland. She was estranged from her husband, and it was said that she was a regular at Goldie's Bar. Again, this is something that's going to come up a lot.
Yeah, it does.
Goldie's Bar plays a very central role in this case, because a lot of the victims either were seen prior to their death, or they frequented Goldie's. Now, as the detectives were creating a timeline for Helen Patton, they determined that the last time she was seen was by her former husband, Kermit, on the 19th. So we know that's the last time she was seen. So I think they using that timeline, that's where they're basing the fact that she was most likely killed on the 19th, even though, as we said, her body would not be found
26, 27, 28.
At least a week later.
Yeah.
You know, Kermit, her husband, identified the body. And I guess what was strange is, you know, they weren't married any longer, or they were estranged, either way. Mm-hmm. But they still lived together.
Yeah, that happens.
It does happen.
Yeah.
So what Kermit had told the police was that Helen had left the week before, without mentioning where she was going. But again, that wasn't unusual, because they were separated, even though they were living together. They were basically living separate lives.
Yeah.
At that point. Now, like we talked about, Patton frequented the bars in the area, especially Goldie's. And it was suspected that maybe she had met a stranger, and that stranger had raped and murdered her. There was no talk of prostitution in the newspapers, but I think as some of the other incidents we're going to talk about unfolded, that becomes a greater possibility. All right, Gibb, so we have to fast forward to January 3rd of 1986. And this is when they find Anna Carroll, who's 68 years old, dead inside her home. Now, the door to her apartment standing wide open. Now, it's January in Philadelphia, so probably pretty cold, winter day. She's lying on the floor of her bedroom. Again, she's nude from the waist down, and she's been stabbed 6 times in the back and has a huge gaping wound from her breastbone all the way down to her groin.
Wow.
And it was almost like the killer was trying to gut the body. Almost like, you know, like you would a deer. That kind of cut. And they said it was post-mortem. So this is after she's dead.
And did I hear this right, that he left like a kitchen knife in her body?
Yes. You're absolutely right. I mean, the kitchen knife, and I'm assuming this is the knife that he made the gaping wound with.
Yeah.
And then just leaves it in the body.
Man.
So just picture that in your mind.
Yeah.
That's a very, very macabre scene for somebody to stumble upon. Now, one thing that's interesting is that Carol is found. Now, keep in mind, we're in Frankfurt, right? But she's found about 10 miles away from where Helen Patton was found. Both of the killings happened at night. And as we described, there were some similarities in how the bodies were found, right? Nude from the waist down, the stabbings. There are some things there to tie.
Yeah.
The other thing that ties these two together is that, like Helen, Anna was, she frequented Goldie's.
Yeah, she was in
there quite a bit.
Quite a bit, yeah.
By all accounts. So, you know, I think me and you sitting here looking at facts, it's pretty easy for us to see that, you know, there's some connection to these two murders.
Yeah, I mean, immediately for me, the Golden Bar, or known as Goldie's, right,
yeah,
is coming right up to the surface.
But, and I think law enforcement was going down that same path of making the connection. But at this point, I don't think they've linked up the investigations. So I still think they're doing separate investigations, but maybe they've got an inkling that there might be a connection here. So the next murder occurs on December 25th, Christmas Day, 1986. So this is, you know, quite some time. It's almost a year, right, before the next murder. So the span between the first two murders was approximately, what?
Yeah, 6 months.
4 or 5, 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, now we've spanned almost a year. And again, a woman is found stabbed. Her name is Susan Olziff. Now, Susan's 74 years old. So here's another pattern I want to talk about, is the age of the victims. Right? Susan is 74. Anna's 68. So I don't know, but there's some pattern there, right? There's the first three women, they're over 50.
Okay.
So is that a type? You know, we talk about that a lot.
Yeah, it could be.
Is that the killer's type, that he prefers women of a certain age? Or is it because he feels that maybe those women are more vulnerable?
I think it's probably the latter.
You think it's the second one?
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe a combination of both?
Yeah, could, you know, be.
Speculating, but...
Right, but we're going to kind of see as time goes on what it's all really about.
Yeah, setting it up. You know, my technique for setting it up.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's get back to Susan. Very, very similar to the previous murder, right? Her neighbors find her door open. Again, it's December in Philadelphia. I'm sure it's cold. They discover the body. She's been stabbed exactly 6 times in the back. The exact same number and the exact same place that Anna Carroll was stabbed. Now, what she didn't have is the big gaping cut
across her
from
abdomen and
down to her groin. She didn't have that, but that's more than coincidence, right? That she's found in basically the same way with the same exact number of stab wounds,
right,
to the same part of the body.
And again, it also happened to be within 7 miles of the first murder.
Yeah.
So again, as far as if you're drawing a circle around the map, you know, it's all pretty tight right there in one region.
And that's another thing I think that is very interesting about this case. You know, we talk about people that travel the country or operate in multiple states. This killer is operating in a radius of one suburb of Philadelphia.
Now, I would say that this suburb is frequent a lot with a lot of not locals, right? Because you have all the bars in this area and some restaurants and some different clubs and stuff like that. So you're going to get a lot of transient people coming through. So really, for someone that likes to kill, it's kind of an open playground.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Are you talking about today or are you talking 1980s?
No, I'm talking back in the 80s. It was a pretty, as far as like bars, a lot of bars in the area. Oh, okay. Right?
Yeah.
So, you know, people would get off the L.
So you're not saying this was not a tourist destination.
No.
Okay.
No, I'm just saying there was a lot of people that didn't live in that area that went to this area.
Okay, because, yeah, I think we definitely want to talk about the city of Frankfurt back in the 80s.
Yes.
And by all accounts, it's much different than it is today.
Oh, yeah.
I read some stuff about the fact that, I guess today it's been revitalized and maybe there's some, you know, some really nice things going on. But in the 80s, I think it had become run down.
Yeah. But it had a lot of bars.
Well, which,
when I'm talking bars, I'm not talking like the bars we see today, right? You know, when you walk into the really nice bars and, you know, these were just
dive bars.
Yeah, dive bars. Yeah, hole in the walls.
I mean, I know you go to a lot of bars, but.
Well, you know.
When you're. So, talking about Frankfurt. I mean, yeah, we are trying to set the scene, trying to set the picture a little bit. Like I said, I think it had become run down. There was a lot of crime. There was a lot of prostitution and drugs in certain areas. Like you said, a lot of bars.
Mm-hmm.
One of the very, I thought this was very interesting. Frankfurt was selected by Sylvester Stallone for a lot of the different settings for the movie Rocky.
Yeah, probably when he was coming up, when he was living in that little one-room apartment, right? And the guys are out around the 55-gallon trash can burning wood, right? I remember that scene.
Yeah, that's the only thing. I don't know exactly which scenes, but that in my mind,
that's what I picture.
That's what I'm picturing.
Yeah.
So maybe row houses and.
Yeah. Like you said, row houses.
It seems like there was a lot of row houses.
Row houses and like you said, the dive bars.
Yeah. So I don't know. Maybe that help. Hopefully that helps paint a picture.
Yeah.
Because who hasn't seen Rocky? Most people. The other thing I found very interesting, Gibbs, is what else was going on in that time period in Philadelphia. In the same time period that we're talking about that this Frankfurt slasher is operating, Philadelphia has a couple of other serial killers running around.
Yeah, they do.
That eventually, you know, we may do on true crime all the time, but you've got Gary Heidnik, Harrison Graham, both active kind of during this same period of time. Now, obviously, we know these guys' names because they were caught and their murders were solved. But think about three pretty prolific serial killers operating at the same time. Yeah, that's a little scary.
Yeah, if you lived in the Philadelphia area, you'd be a little concerned, right? I mean, you got somebody slashing bodies over here. You got another guy over here that they find decomposing bodies in his apartment.
Yeah. The news would have been interesting.
Yeah, let's put it that way. Yeah, for sure. And then the other guy, I mean, hanging people from chains or something like that, I read.
Yeah, is that Heidnik?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was something else.
Yeah, he was something. What a character. So, anyway, I just, I don't know, but I thought about maybe moving.
From Philly. Yeah. No, we're giving Philly a bad name.
No, not just because there was this, man, that was a lot of activity. Now, granted, Philadelphia is a huge
city. It is a huge city. So people might not even have noticed.
Yeah, unless you lived in that ward, district, whatever they called them.
Right, it was pretty big. All right, so let's talk about the next victim. And this is where it kind of goes against what I had talked about earlier, because Jean Durkin, she's only 28 years old.
Yeah, she's young.
She's younger than all the previous victims. And she's found on January 8th, 1987. Again, conflicting information on this one, because whether you could, it's either that she was found underneath a fruit stand on Frankfort Avenue, or she was found under a truck.
Under the, I got underneath the storage truck.
Right.
And I have, you got this other guy that says that she was underneath a fruit vegetable stand.
Yeah.
On Pratt Street.
So, two different things.
Yeah.
Now, Jean lived on the streets by all accounts, and mostly in doorways, and especially in one doorway of an abandoned bakery that was just two buildings away from Goldie. So here again, here comes Goldie's back in.
Yeah. Because she would go into Goldie's during the
when it got really cold.
Yeah, to get warmed up.
Yep. So there was talk about the fact that she did live on the streets really could have made her an easy target or victim for rape or murder. But when the detective started interviewing people that knew her, they kind of painted a different picture. They painted a picture of somebody that would not have been overwhelmed easily.
Yeah, she, from everything that they talk about, she was pretty tough.
Yeah, to the point that at one point she was being arrested, and it took six policemen, and she struggled so much that at one point it said they gave up. They literally could not contain her and arrest her. Obviously, I don't know. They probably weren't trying to arrest her for anything too big, or they wouldn't have given up. But
yeah. But she,
at some point they said, hey, this ain't worth it.
Yeah, it's not worth us getting anybody getting hurt.
Right.
You know, but for six of them not to be able to contain her, that tells you something.
Well, and it paints a picture of that this person, you know, maybe hard scrabble on the streets, not somebody to take that to be taken lightly. I'll put it that way.
So she's found about a block from where Helen Patton was found.
Yeah, close.
Yeah. And how many times was she stabbed?
74 times.
74 times. So when I think about that, I think about she probably did put up a fight, because it probably just aggravated the killer that he kept stabbing and stabbing until he got her not to move, and then even more so. So we find out she's been stabbed in the chest and the buttocks 74 times. That's just, that just blows me away.
Well, I think, yeah, one reason it probably should blow you away, because just think about the actual mechanics of stabbing somebody 74 times. I mean, that's a lot of expended energy.
Yeah, it was so much force that they had blood splatter that it went up on the fence behind her.
Yeah.
And it was up on the truck as well, right? And the weird thing was, not weird, it's lining everything together. Like, she was found nude from the waist down.
Mm-hmm.
She was found with her legs spread wide open.
Yes.
Right? So, I mean, again, here's, you know, very similar things happening to her in the same area. I mean,
And she had been sexually assaulted.
Sexually assaulted as well.
And I think it's at this point that the police really start to put it together. And they know that all four of these victims are linked and that they most likely have a serial killer on their hands, because it's not too long after, pretty quickly after this, that they form a task force. They start canvassing the neighborhoods around Frankfurt. And they're just looking for anybody that maybe could have been a witness or anything related to the victims. And that's where they start questioning people at Goldie's. And I think they question the bartender. Like you talked about, they say that she came in, Jean came in there when it was really cold to warm up. But they also talked to a lot of customers. And the bartender had one thing to say that I think was very interesting.
I think it's very, very interesting.
And I assume we're talking about the same thing, but that's that she thought that the killer was a customer.
Yeah.
And how could you not, when Goldie's is basically at the center of all four of these so far?
Right. I mean, it's the common denominator.
Yeah. So it would just make sense that you've either got a customer or somebody that frequents Goldie's that is either seeing these women or knows these women. I don't know how you could not think that. I think at one point, Gibbs, she actually even gives them a man's name that she believes it could be. But she doesn't have anything really to back it up.
Right, just some...
some kind of...
gut instinct.
Yeah, intuition, suspicion, right, whatever you want to call it.
There's also another interesting story that comes out of them interviewing, right? Because they go in and they talk to the bar, and they're talking about...
They talk to the bar.
They go in and they talk to the bartender. During their interview with the patrons at the bar, one fact that comes out about Durkin's killing was that it was mentioned at one point there was another patron named Michelle Martin. And Michelle, she frequent the same bars. She frequent Goldie's. And at one point, Durkin and Martin got into a fight over a blanket. And
because I'm assuming that she was maybe living on the streets as well.
Right. And they got into this fight. And some reason it stood out that it happened days before Durkin's murder. So that's why it kind of brought it up. And again, you know, like we said, we knew that Durkin was been living on the streets for at least 5+ years. So, but everybody remembered that this altercation happened and it was over a blanket. So that was brought up. But it's interesting because it kind of comes around later.
All right. So Gibbs, let's talk about Catherine Jones. Catherine Jones was 29 years old. She was killed in January of 87. So this would have been basically around the same time as Jean Durkin. This is the one that we talked about in the very beginning, where the connection to the rest of these murders is very cloudy. So it could be part of the Frankfurt slasher, but it's not, it doesn't have the ties that the other ones do.
Right.
So it's mentioned, but that's why people say it's 8, could be 9 if Catherine Jones
was
a victim of the slasher. But we won't spend a lot of time on her because there's really not the details that back it up. And that's why there's not a lot of evidence that, that she was a slasher victim. But we get to Margaret Vaughn. Margaret's 66. So here again, I do want to talk about the ages because, you know, I don't know what importance it plays.
Yeah, I don't really, you know, because he's a lot of, you know, three or four victims in the 60s range, plus or minus, right, 10 years.
And then goes down to 28.
Yeah, 28, 29, 30, you know, those ages, so.
And normally I think you see a lot of times where a serial killer has a type, and that type includes an age range, but it's normally not this big a difference. And that's the only reason I bring it up. I don't know what it means. Just throwing it out there. So we get to Margaret Vaughn. Margaret's 66. And they find her mutilated on November 11th, 1988. So again, this is almost 2 years of a break, right? We're going from Jean Durkin, January of 87, and even Catherine Jones, if you're counting that, was January 87. The next murder doesn't occur till November of 88. That's a long span.
It is a long span.
And, you know, that's part of the definition of a serial killer, right? It's three or more victims with breaks in between. So we're definitely talking about a serial killer here. There's no doubt about that.
And some of the facts here get a little more interesting, I think, right? Because we're going to dive into some more details maybe about a possible suspect.
So Margaret was found in an apartment building entryway. And again, stabbed many, many times. I think 29, 30 some times.
Yeah, she just was evicted from this place.
Yeah.
Which was weird.
So I don't know what she's doing in the entryway. Maybe she's living there.
Versus being on the streets, maybe.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe she's holing up there like Jean was. But again, she's killed just three blocks from where Jean Durkin had been killed, which means she can't be very far from Goldie's.
Right.
Because Goldie's was just down from where they found Jean Durkin. And back again, we're talking about a bartender saying that Vaughn had been in the bar just the evening before her death. And now we get into what I think you were hinting at, a possible suspect.
Yeah.
And this starts to become what people say, that the victims are seen with a Caucasian male who has a round face, walks with a limp, and wears glasses. And not just the fact that they had been seen, but they've been actually drinking together, is what the bartender reported to police.
Yeah.
So to add to that, the bartender was actually able to give enough details to the police sketch artist to get a pretty good, you know, composite drawing.
Yeah.
And that was sent all around town. But nobody comes forward to say they know who this person is, or they even think they know who this person is.
Yeah. But the theories out there, you know, with Goldie's, is that whoever this person is would go to this bar a lot, run into these women, and would see them more than one occasion. Like he would befriend them and kind of build up a little rapport with them. And then, of course, when the time was right, he would do what he wanted to do.
Yeah, but see, to me, that theory is even more strange. Because the more time you would spend with somebody before you would kill them, the more likely that you would be seen with this person.
You True. Know, yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean you're definitely opening yourself up for, as far as being a suspect.
Right.
Right?
Better identification. So the fact that, and I'm not saying that theory is not true, but the fact that if that's the way it happened, you would think they would have had an even better chance of catching this guy.
Right.
And obviously we know they don't, because it wouldn't be on Unsolved.
True.
So at this point, the composite is out there, and I've got it up on the Facebook page. Everybody can take a look at it.
But no one comes forward. No one identifies him. No, no one says, we know who he is.
Okay. No, not at all. Now, the killer doesn't wait as long to strike again. He only waits a couple months this time. And the victim is Teresa Ciartino, and she's only 30 years old. So again, he's got a pretty big fluctuation in ages. I still don't know what that means, but in the back of my head, I think it means something, but I don't know. So we're January 19th, 1989, and they find Teresa in her apartment. She's nude, except for she's still wearing her socks.
Mm-hmm.
And she's been stabbed 25 times. So these similarities, and again, this is not a person who, you know, slashes a throat or stabs a couple times into a vital organ.
No, man, he's like hitting her, slashing her face, her arms, her chest.
And the number. I mean, it's vicious, right? One was, what do we say, 70, was it 74?
70, yeah.
And even these other ones, they're 20, 30. I mean, that's a lot of stabbing.
And then on this one, he gets kind of even, you know, and he sexually assaults all these women. But this time, he even grabs a 3-foot piece of wood and sexually assaults her with that. So he's getting a little more disturbed.
Now, he does make a mistake here, because he leaves the weapon leaning against the sink, and he also leaves a bloody footprint behind. Because obviously, I mean, all of these killings that we're talking about, they had to be extremely bloody.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this one, they said there was blood all over the kitchen floor. She's faced up. There's blood splatter everywhere. So, I mean, the force he's using with the knife when he's penetrating her body, you know, the skin, I mean, it's the force of it's just making the blood go everywhere. So the anger, right, that he had.
And that's what I think. When I think of the large number of stabs, I think anger.
Yeah, I do too.
But the other thing I think of is so much blood. How is this guy walking away from all of these crime scenes
and no one noticing?
He has to be covered in blood.
You would think.
Because, like, you know, the spurt. There has to be spurt.
What's he doing? Taking his clothes off, killing him, and then putting his clothes back on?
I don't know. Unless he's using like a Dexter move where he's wearing an outfit that he can take off before he
walks out. And but I mean, wouldn't you think somebody would have found the bloodstained clothes somewhere that we dispose of them, or who knows?
I don't know, but that it's a
mystery.
I kept thinking about that as I was researching, how's this guy getting away from all these crime scenes? Because he has to be covered in blood. Now he leaves behind this bloody footprint, and you know, obviously they're able to figure something out from that. You know, what kind of shoe, what size foot this guy has, but
pretty limited information.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that alone.
How many of those people have that size foot, that size type of shoe in Philadelphia? You know.
Philadelphia?
Philadelphia.
Say that again.
Philadelphia?
Say it real.
Philadelphia?
No, say it like you mean it.
Philadelphia.
So I think we have to point out the similarities. The other similarities is Ciartino frequented in the bars, just like the other victims. And also, it was reported that she had been seen with a middle-aged white male just before her death.
I want to say coincidence? I don't think so.
I don't think so at all.
Yeah.
All right, Gibbs, this takes us up to Carol Dowd. Carol Dowd's 46 years old, and it also brings us up to April 29th of 1990, which again, this is over a year. I mean, you're talking 15 months or so, 15, 16 months later.
Mm-hmm.
So he's taking a big break. And it's about 2 o'clock in the morning when a police officer finds the nude body of Carol Dowd in an alley behind Newman Seafood. And this is on Frankfort Avenue. She had been stabbed 36 times all over, face, neck, chest, and back. And not only was she stabbed, but her head and face was battered.
Yeah. Beaten in pretty severe.
Yeah, beaten very, very severely. And that's not even the worst part.
No.
Because her stomach is cut open to the point where her intestines are spilling out. Again, I'm picturing this in my head, and it's gruesome.
It is gruesome. And then they talk about how her left nipple was removed, too.
Now, it was noted that Carol had a lot of defensive wounds on her hands, so it was pretty obvious that she had been fending off an attacker and had put up quite a fight. The police estimated that she was murdered sometime after midnight, but before 1:40 a.m. And really, I think the only reason that the officer stumbled upon her is that he had been checking the area because of some burglary that had happened prior, or, you know, some days before.
Yeah. And before she was murdered, hours before, a witness tells the police that they saw her walking around the neighborhood with an older white gentleman.
Yeah.
So
we mentioned that she was found nude, but then her clothing was found kind of balled up near her body. Her purse was in the alley, open, spilled, you know, everything spilled all over the ground. But the strange part was nothing seemed to have been taken. So it didn't fit in with like a robbery type situation at first.
At first.
Now, I think Dowd had some mental issues. There was some reports from members of the family that she had been saying to them that she had been hearing voices. She was diagnosed with some type of paranoid schizophrenia. And at one point, I think she was even institutionalized.
Well, and they also said the homeless girl had it too, Jenny Durkin.
Mm. So I think at first, Gibbs, the police automatically suspect that, you know, this is the same killer.
You would think. I mean, naked, guts split open.
Same kind of MO. They're getting reports that this lady, Carol Dowd, had been seen with an older white gentleman. It's all kind of matching what we've heard about the previous victims. And I think the police now are starting to get some theories. And one of the theories is that this guy is following these victims home at night when they leave the bars. And he's grabbing them at some point along the way and then committing the murders. But this is where things start to go a little sideways. Because, you know, we mentioned that this murder happened right behind this place called Newman Seafood. And there was a guy that worked at Newman's. His name was Leonard Christopher. And the police are interviewing the different employees of the fish market there. And they interview Leonard. And for some reason, he doesn't do well in the interview. And he starts making some statements that really put him in a bad light. And I think one of the statements is that he knew one of the prior victims, Margaret Vaughn. And it's at this point that I think the police start to cast their suspicion on him. Now, I'm not sure exactly why at this point, when by all accounts, they're looking for an older white male.
Right.
if they believe that all these murders are tied together and that Carol Dowd is also tied with the rest of them, but they start to question Leonard more. And at some point he says, they ask him where he was that night and he lies. He gives them a story that's not corroborated by his girlfriend. So that leads them down the path to, you know, more intense questioning. But Gibbs, I think what really puts Christopher in the crosshairs of police is that there are a couple of witnesses that are interviewed. One of them puts him with Dowd in the bar on the night she was killed. Another witness who for some reason had lied initially admits finally to having seen them together outside of the bar and also putting them both in the alley behind the fish store. And then the big one is that this same witness says she saw Christopher sweating and that he had a large knife in his belt.
Well, that's a pretty good sign.
That's pretty damning evidence.
Yeah.
A search of his apartment turned up some clothing with blood on it. But there was some, maybe a reason for that. There was a person that Christopher worked with at the fish market that said that their boss had told Christopher to go out and clean up the blood. Obviously, after the police had done everything they need to do, so that, you know, his friend at the fish market is saying, well, yeah, no doubt he would have had blood all over him because he was out there cleaning up this tremendous amount of blood in the alley. There was a lot of people that came forward that said, you know, this is a great guy. They were vouching for his character. And even his landlord had nothing but good things to say about him other than every now and then he made too much noise. Right. So not a lot of people coming forward and saying, hey, this is a bad guy. Now, one thing we haven't mentioned is that Christopher was African-American. So that puts him in direct odds.
Well, sure, with a lot of the witness statements about the other ones.
Right. With every known, you know, everything we know about is that most likely we're looking for a middle-aged white male. And Christopher is definitely not that.
No, he's good with a knife. He's working at the fish market.
Well, that's true.
So you're filleting those fish, you can fillet about anything.
That is true. I never thought about that. But he's arrested.
Mm-hmm.
And he's arrested, I assume, based on a couple of witnesses that had some pretty, you know, damning information against him. So he has to stand trial for the murder of Carol Dowd. Now, once he's in custody, there are some other people that come forward with some more information that does not paint him in a very good light. There's another woman comes forward that says that she saw him in the alley around 1 a.m. and then she heard a woman scream. Another woman claims to have seen Christopher leave the alley carrying his shirt over his arm and with a knife hanging around his waist. So again, you got some, you know, if this stuff is true, then it paints him in a very bad light.
It's matching up with the other witness too, so.
Yeah. So Leonard Christopher is in jail, right, awaiting trial. And on September 6th of 1990, another woman is found murdered. And this is Michelle Daner. She's 30 years old.
Also known as Michelle Martin.
So this comes back to the person that you were talking about before that had the fight with Gene Durkin.
Right. Over the blanket.
Right. So I'm not sure what happened. Did she get married?
I'm guessing she got married then.
Yeah. So her name is now Michelle Daner. When she's killed, by all accounts, her name is Michelle Daner. But keep in mind, Leonard Christopher is in jail. So he obviously could not have killed Michelle Daner.
She was found laying on the floor. She was stabbed 23 times in the chest and the stomach. And, you know, at this point, they, you know, they're thinking this is a Frankfurt slasher.
It sure fits the same details of the others.
Yeah.
You know, another thing that kind of matches up, and we talked about it a little bit with some of the other victims where the doors had been left open. What we didn't mention is there was no signs of forced entry.
Yeah.
Like the doors had not been kicked in or...
Like they knew the person.
Right.
Right.
And I think that's one of the big theories in this case. And you touched on it a little bit. And we've said that some of these theories are is that this person, the Frankfurt slasher, to what degree, I don't know, but got to know these victims enough to the point where they would either let him in if they had an apartment or they would let their guard down in some of these cases where the altercations happened outside. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, they talk a lot about how this individual befriended a lot of them. You know, again, this is like a lot of bars in this area at that time, you know, dives, whatever you want to call them, but there were still bars. And, you know, it's mentioned that Michelle pretty much hung out at the bars all the time.
Right.
Right.
She fits drank the same pattern.
Yeah, she was at the bar during the day, at nighttime. She really didn't work. Every now and then she would sell hot soft pretzels. They're always hot anyway, right? It was mentioned that if she wasn't at the bars, the only time she really did anything as far as for money was she would sell soft pretzels. Otherwise, she was basically going bar to bar, day and night.
Well,
and
she even had, people even called her Crazy Michelle.
Yeah, yeah, it was her nickname in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
So. Now, I mean, she was a hard-drinking, paranoid person, is what...
That kept to herself.
Yeah.
By all accounts.
Right.
But, so a couple of facts. Again, no forced entry on this one. And this murder occurred just 3 blocks from where Carol Dowd had been killed and on the same exact street where Teresa Ciortino was killed. So again, like we talked about, this is all happening within... a fairly small radius.
Yeah. A day and a half before her death, it was reported that she was seen leaving the bar with a white male. And to the point that they even made mention that people had been seeing her bring home this white male a few occasions. And this was someone that was paranoid, right? And you know, we eventually started out that her name changed. So maybe... she had the maiden name was Martin. She got married, and clearly maybe that didn't work out because she's bringing home a person from a bar. She must not have been still married, right? I wouldn't think that she would be married and bringing home a stranger. So who knows?
Who knows?
Right? But there's accounts from witnesses that she did bring home this white gentleman.
So one of the things that I think came out of this killing is that people started to question the fact of whether, you know, Christopher was really the right person for the murder of Carol Dowd.
Yeah, I think you're right, because they were probably feeling pretty safe because they probably thought the police got the guy, right? Because the MO, I mean, when you think about her murder... Carol's now,
very similar.
So they're probably thinking, oh good, this is wrapped up, we can start walking the streets, feel good about ourselves. But then this happens,
right? So now they're questioning it. Now again, he doesn't match the description, but I don't know how many people, you know, put all that together. I have a feeling a lot of people just knew that he was arrested. They felt a lot safer thinking that they had caught the serial killer.
Sure.
But now somebody is murdered in the exact same way, and they know it can't be Leonard Christopher because...
Yeah, he's locked up.
Yeah. It just can't be. So that had to put a lot of people back on edge and with a good deal of panic. Because obviously, if he's not the guy, the guy's still out there. And the only other option would be that this was a copycat if he really was the Frankfurt slasher. That's the only other...
And that could be one theory.
Theory, right? That makes sense.
Yeah. It's just really strange that all these killings were very forceful, right? And we touched on it already, but when you have that much force, that much blood, again, in a very populated area, that no one is witness to somebody with blood all over them.
Right. I think that's a huge issue.
Yeah.
The second one is they've got a good composite sketch that's all around town. Not a single person has come forward to say this is a viable suspect. You know, what I do think was happening was that there was people all over town pointing at people they thought could have been the suspect.
Yeah, I mean, I heard there's a bus driver, right, that they thought, some of the elderly women thought the bus driver had an issue with them and maybe this was his way. But again, that was for the elderly. Remember, some of these victims were 28, 29.
Yeah.
So
at one point, I think there was a cult that people thought may have been involved that allegedly did practice some of their Satan worship in a park that was pretty close to where all this stuff was happening.
And this was the early 80s, so...
Satanic panic.
Yeah. I mean, we know that there's a lot of things going on in that cult world back then.
Right. But again, the best clue they had, or I would say the best two clues they had, is number one, the composite, and number two is the footprint that was left in blood. And again, like we said, they had the shoe manufacturer, they had what size it was. Now, at some point, they did find a man, and they linked him somehow. He had similar shoes. They were the right size. And this person apparently knew at least one of the victims. And I think he was one of the victim's boyfriends is what came out ultimately. But he was never linked to the crime.
So pretty weak evidence against this guy that had the shoe, you know, that was the boyfriend, it sounds like. That, you know, and who knows, maybe he stumbled across the scene afterwards, panicked, and that's how his footprint, you know, we just don't know.
Yeah.
So the bottom line is, though, is after Michelle's killing, nothing happens again.
Nothing.
So was it a copy? Was Michelle's a copycat and they actually got the right person with Leonard? Well, or
when you say nothing happens, there's no other killings.
Yes.
But they do convict Leonard Christopher.
Right.
Of the murder of Carol Dowd.
Yeah.
That does happen.
Yeah. And so, you know, was Leonard the actual killer of all of them besides Michelle? And like you said, was Michelle just a copycat? Because, you know, I mean, you study a lot of these serial killers. You know there's copycat serial killers out there.
Oh, there are people that, you know, commit copycat crimes. Yeah. So,
and clearly, this part of Philadelphia had a lot of serial killers going on, right? As we talked about in the beginning. You know, you had this going on. You had the...
Heidnick
and
Harrison Graham.
Yeah. So could there have been a copycat guy out there? Sure.
So we talked about Christopher being convicted, but I think what's important is that there was no evidence, and you know they looked at it. They looked at it hard. There was no evidence whatsoever that would tie Leonard Christopher to any of the other murders. Not one shred of evidence. And you know that they spent a lot of time trying to pin some of that, some of the other ones on him. They had to have.
Well, sure. I mean, what prosecutor wouldn't try to do
He's already in jail for one.
Right.
They're going to try to dig up and see if they can't pin any of the others. So the fact that they couldn't, I think that means something.
Yeah.
Not one shred, not one single bit of evidence.
I don't know how you have a guy like that that kills Carol the way he did, which was so similar to some of the other killings.
But, okay, I agree with that. But how important is it that there was never another single murder that matched everything after that 1990 murder?
Yeah.
And what does that mean? Does that mean that the guy did it? He saw Christopher get nailed for the one. He did it one more time and then thought, you know, I'm out of here.
Yeah, I'm out of here.
Or
maybe he,
did he die? Did he move? I mean, you know, there's all kinds of theories. You know, maybe Christopher did kill Carol Dowd, and maybe it just was a coincidence that it shared a lot of the same characteristics as the other seven.
Right.
Right. Because we're not even counting that one.
Right.
That would be number nine.
Right.
As part of the Frankfurt slasher. But I think there's a lot of people that don't believe he's guilty at all.
Oh, that he's has zero guilt.
Yes.
He just had the blood because he went and cleaned it up.
Right.
And they needed to find somebody to pin something on. So you're saying that some people say the slasher was responsible for all these.
Yes.
He was never caught. It wasn't Christopher, Leonard Christopher, that did anything. I think they were just needing to pin this on somebody to, I really do. I think, you know, you could see how they just needed to pin this to get the community feeling safe, to get.
Well, we know there's always a lot of pressure.
Sure.
Especially, I mean, there's pressure in every murder. But when you've got 6, 7, 8 that are piling up,
yeah,
the severity, you know, 20, oh, 30, 74 in that one instance.
Yeah, 74 stabs.
Complete ripping of the abdomen, spilling intestines. I mean, these are gruesome, gruesome murders.
Yeah, absolutely.
The amount of pressure on the police would have been enormous. So I really don't know, to be honest with you, whether Leonard Christopher is guilty or not. But there are, all I'm saying is there are a lot of people out there that are not convinced of his guilt.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way. There's a lot of questions about the evidence that was used to convict him. You definitely have to look at the fact that he doesn't match any of the witness reports of this white, middle-aged male.
And if he's working at the fish market,
he would have a knife.
He would have a knife on him.
Right.
And
it would probably be in a holster.
On his belt.
Right.
But that would be typical, you know? So,
now, would he be walking around with it at 1 o'clock in the morning?
Well, if he's leaving to go home.
That part I don't know.
You know? I don't know what they did back then. I don't know if the knife was his or the company's.
Sure.
And
we, you know, you and I don't have all the evidence that was involved.
Right.
But you can make some arguments both ways. There was some strong witness statements against him. But again, are those truthful?
Right.
And then some of the some of the other types of evidence, the blood. Right. If he really was asked to go clean up the blood, then sure, he's going to have her blood on him.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe if the slasher's still out there, he can call in.
I swear every episode you want somebody to call, email.
I do.
If you're the slasher and you're listening to this
email
podcast,
email us or call or drop us a line somehow.
Please call Gibby at his home number.
Yeah.
Blank, blank, blank.
Yeah.
Blank, blank.
Or visit him at his house at.
Yeah. Now, again, you know, this is, we're going on what?
Well, this is
30 some, almost 40 years. No.
Almost 30 years. Yeah.
So a middle-aged white male, and I don't even know what we're calling middle-aged nowadays, because you and I are
this is, say he might be in his 70s.
Yeah, 70s, 80s.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah, somewhere around there.
But, so here's one thing we haven't talked about. We did talk about the severity of the knife work, I'll call it. What I'm surprised about is that normally, I shouldn't say normally, a lot of times when you're, when you've got that much knife work involved, that much force, the chances that you're not either going to cut yourself or, you know, hit the victim and it somehow slipped down and you nick part of your body.
Right.
I'm surprised that.
Unless you're really good with a knife.
Well, that's true.
And use it every day in your job. You
worked at a fish market?
Yeah. Who knows?
I don't know. You know what would be interesting, really amazing, is hopefully one of these unsolved that we do eventually is going to get solved. And then we can come back and...
Yeah, see if our any of our theories...
Revisit it.
Right.
I'm going with... All right, let's do final theories. That should be a segment at the end of every one.
Sure.
I'm going with the fact that I just think there's too much middle-aged white male to be discounted. And so it's either that a middle-aged white male killed seven people and Leonard Christopher just happened to kill Carol Dowd and it just happened to bear a very, very strong, you know, have all the same characteristics as all these other murders, or he did, Leonard Christopher killed the first seven, went to jail, and somebody copycatted him on the eighth, or he didn't do it at all, and the same middle-aged white male killed all eight. That's the three scenarios in my mind.
Or he, out of the eight, he killed a few of them and somebody else killed the other ones.
Yeah, I guess that's
good.
You could split
it down that way.
Yeah.
So it's interesting.
It is.
Now,
the question is, were you in Philadelphia? Were you in the Frankfurt area in the mid to late 80s?
Late 80s and early 90s with my K-bar knife?
With your K-bar knife. Were you anywhere around there? Because I got to know that before we end the episode.
Yeah, I wouldn't have been a middle-aged white male, though. I was a little bit younger.
A little bit. All right.
I would have been...
You're still suspect.
I'd have been 20. I would have been 20 something.
You're still suspect. Yeah, in everyone, I'm figuring out a way to make you a suspect. Yeah.
Make me a suspect in it?
You're suspect. All right, that's the story of the Frankfurt Slasher. I hope everybody liked it. Another episode of True Crime All the Time Unsolved in the bag. I'm Mike Ferguson.
I'm Gibby.
For everybody out there, stay safe and keep your own time ticking.